From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up, a Trump executive order that has not gotten as much attention instructs agents to pick up any undocumented person they come across.
We have to ask ourselves, is this worth the moral cost to just go out and arrest people and suddenly become like we're kind of a police state?
We'll talk about eliminating the income tax in Michigan and whether the state needs $1 billion or more in its rainy day fund.
My view, and I think the governor's view, is that if you can't build a savings account during relatively good economic times, you're never going to have one when you need one.
There's been talk in Washington about eliminating the EPA, but what's the EPA ever done for Michigan?
In regards to the Kalamazoo River oil spill, EPA took the lead role in ensuring that the cleanup standards were met.
Plus, we'll open the stateside mailbag and hear some listeners' comments. But first, here's the latest news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. What does the Environmental Protection Agency do for Michigan? The short answer?
Every time a business in the state is getting a permit that allows them to emit air pollution or water pollution, in some respects, our EPA is involved.
Short answer is a lot. Later this hour, a look at the job of the EPA in our state. But first, a federal appeals panel in the Ninth Circuit has upheld a lower court's ruling against an executive order by President Donald Trump. That order temporarily banned people of seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the U.S. The three-judge panel suggested the executive order did nothing to make the nation safer and that the Trump administration didn't present any evidence that people from the seven countries were a threat to the U.S. Duad Walid is an executive director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations in Michigan. So what's your reaction to this ruling?
We welcome the ruling of the Ninth Circuit in which those three judges unanimously ruled to block the Trump executive order in relationship to the lower court ruling. I think this sends a powerful message that there were not just civil rights groups such as CARE, the ACLU, who had filed this motion that went to the court, but that this was a lawsuit that was filed by two states within our country that showed clearly the violation of the Establishment Clause, as well as the harm that it was doing to American institutions such as businesses and universities in terms of this, what we believe to be unconstitutional order by Mr. Trump.
So the president, Mr. Trump, tweeted in all caps, "See you in court." The reports are he's outraged. He's furious about this ruling. I'm just wondering, how quickly do you expect this to work through the court system?
I'm sure the Department of Justice will probably file an appeal and that this will end up going to the Supreme Court regarding this temporary injunction. But keep in mind that the Council on American-Islamic Relations filed a suit, which I'm one of the plaintiffs, is actually challenging the Trump executive order, not long-term, and was not a lawsuit filing or seeking a temporary injunction. So this issue may be adjudicated somewhat quickly if it makes it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court obviously has the discretion to not hear the case and to basically affirm the lower court's ruling. But the longer court ruling or the longer lawsuit that we filed probably will take years to adjudicate itself fully through the courts of law. So we're going to be dealing with this issue probably for a while in the courts.
How closely are immigrants in those seven countries following what's happening?
They're following things very closely. This ban has made international news, and there are people who reside right here in Michigan, both in the western part of the state and southeastern Michigan, who have family members in those seven affected countries. And we had encouraged people last week in community meetings, and we have one tonight as well as tomorrow night, where we are encouraging community members who have family members with visas to expedite their travel to the United States of America immediately, because this is a very fluid situation. And who knows, if this goes to the Supreme Court may not uphold the lower court's ruling and may actually affirm the Trump executive order. So we really don't know, and this is why we are encouraging people to get their family members to America as soon as possible.
You know, the Trump administration, and for that matter, most journalists, are not calling this a Muslim ban because it does not restrict immigration from the many other countries that are majority Muslim. What do you think about that term, Muslim ban?
Oh, we call it a Muslim exclusion order because that's exactly what it is. It's an exclusion order or a ban, and this is why the courts and civil rights organizations have challenged this according to violation of the Establishment Clause. When Mr. Trump says that he wants to ban immigrants or refugees from 7 Muslim-majority countries and then puts forth a clause or an exception for religious minorities, which really means Christians, it is, in fact, a Muslim ban. It is just done in a very slick way. And Rudy Giuliani actually confessed that he helped craft the language or helped craft the order so that it would serve the purpose of banning Muslims with language that did not overtly say ban Muslims. So it is very evident that it is a Muslim ban.
Dawood Waleed is Executive Director of the Council on American and Islamic Relations in Michigan. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Michigan Governor Rick Snyder released his budget proposal this week. Here to talk about that are Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican legislative leader, and Vicki Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. They are both joining us by Skype. The budget is considered a common sense proposal by many political insiders, with some modest increases for schools and infrastructure. But Snyder also wants to put $260 million into the Budget Stabilization Fund, what we all call the Rainy Day Fund. That will bring it up to about $1 billion. Ken, why is a Rainy Day Fund even necessary?
Well, I think you need a savings account. I remember when I was in the legislature and we had over $1 billion in the Rainy Day Fund, and then the economy went south and we depleted that pretty quickly. And my view, and I think the governor's view, is that if you can't build a savings account during relatively good economic times, you're never going to have one when you need one.
Vicki, the Rainy Day Fund has been as high as $2 billion, or nearly $2 billion. But when the roads are still bad, infrastructure is crumbling, the state is now pulling funds for water subsidies from Flint, how does it look to be stashing those dollars away?
Well, forget the optics for a second, and let's talk about what the Rainy Day Fund is supposed to do. Ken is absolutely right. You have to have a savings account. I'm a former financial planner. We recommend that to all of our clients. But when you're dealing with government, a Rainy Day Fund also signals to bond issuers that you have a healthy economy, and it lowers your interest rate. And when it lowers your interest rate, it affects every project you're going to go bond for, including roads. So it actually saves us money in the long run to have money in our savings account.
So saving money to save money, that's not a bad thing. The Republicans.
Well, it's like when you go to a bank to borrow money. If you don't have money, they're not going to give you money.
The Republicans have an idea for some of the state's surplus. Give it back to the taxpayers. Here's Representative Laura Cox, the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, talking to Cynthia Canty this week.
Well, I'd like to do, the House has a proposal out that we want to do an incremental tax rollback to kind of put a little bit more money in the pockets of the hardworking taxpayers across the state. I think that that's something that's a really big goal of ours, and we want to make sure our citizens get back more of their own money so that they can spend it the way they want to on their budget, instead of sending it away to the state and feeling like they might not have as much control over it as they'd like.
Ken, the plan is to phase out the 4.25% income tax over the next 40 years. There are states that don't have an income tax. What about Michigan?
Well, the handful of states that don't have a state income tax rely on revenue from other sources. You have some small western states that have a lot of mining and mineral extraction. You take a look at Florida, they have a high sales tax, a lot of tourists. You know, Michigan isn't in that situation. That, the basic dilemma with eliminating the state income tax, even if you do it over time, is you've got to cut spending to go along with it. And it's pretty easy for one legislature to put in an income tax phase out and then force a future legislature to deal with the spending cuts that are a consequence. There are already tax cuts built into future state budgets that our previous legislature put into place. But you have this phenomenon with term limits. When a new legislature comes in, new Republicans, it's not good enough to have tax cuts done by a previous legislature. They want to be able to say, we cut your taxes. So you get tax cut upon tax cut upon tax cut.
Yeah, I guess the governor was arguing that they've already got a bunch of fees and reductions coming into place. Vicki, the governor has not said a lot about this idea of a tax cut, except that if you cut revenue, you have to cut spending. How does Michigan cut enough to make up for the loss in income tax revenue?
I don't think you can cut enough. You would have to shift the tax burden to another source, like increasing the sales tax. And when you're talking about eliminating the income tax, you're talking about eliminating over $9 billion of today's dollars. That means you'd have to increase the sales tax to 12 or 13% in order to make up for it. You talked about crumbling roads and crumbling infrastructure. We can see the things that are crumbling, but we can't see the other part of the infrastructure mess that we have to deal with financially as well. And that is something that Fraser is dealing with in Macomb County, Michigan right now. And that's the sinkholes, the breaking of water mains and underground infrastructure that we can't see that hasn't been repaired in generations. So we really are on the cusp of having to raise more revenue to fix our infrastructure and move Michigan forward. And this whole tax cut fever does not address the needs of the real citizens of Michigan right now. And I wouldn't be surprised, though, if you also see another proposal, aside from eliminating the income tax, of moving the income tax from a flat rate to a graduated income tax. That's something that a bill was put in to put on the ballot last term by State Representative Jim Townsend, and I hear there's talk about doing that again. So I don't think we're done with the tax cut talk or the tax shift talk. It'd be interesting to see what happens in the future.
All right, let's go to the lightning round. One sentence or just a few words. Ken, how would you characterize the governor's budget proposal?
Modest and steady. There's some interesting pieces to it, but it's pretty steady and kind of boring.
Vicki?
I think there's some really good things in there, including increasing funding for high school education. I'm disappointed that there's not any money set aside to address the unemployment fund nightmare.
Vicki Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislative leader. Hey, thanks very much as usual, and have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Detroit and Ann Arbor are dotted with buildings from one of the region's celebrated architects. As a matter of fact, that shortchanges the architect because his buildings can be found in places all over the world, and he's not just celebrated in Michigan, but worldwide. We're talking about Albert Kahn. He was a German immigrant in the late 19th century and landing in Detroit at the age of 11.
Kahn was born in a town in southwest Germany called Raunen.
Claire Zimmerman is an associate professor of architecture and history of art at the University of Michigan. She's participating in a two-month-long project at Lawrence Tech University to highlight the work and legacy of Albert Kahn.
He emigrated with his family. His father is referred to as an itinerant rabbi who made his living by traveling to perform the services of a rabbi as needed. They were part of the wave of German immigrants in the second half of the 19th century who came to America for opportunities and to find jobs. His father first came to Baltimore, I believe, and then moved out to Detroit for job opportunities. Kahn was 11 when they came over in 1880. Moritz Kahn, his third brother, was an infant. He was actually born as the family was underway to come to the United States. Kahn was the eldest. He never went back to school. He became instead the patron and supporter of the brothers, many of whom went to the University of Michigan.
So how did he become an architect?
Kahn was good at a couple of things. He was a very good pianist, and he was a very good draftsman. His mother apparently noticed his skill in drawing and apprenticed him with a sculptor named Julius Melchors. Kahn apprenticed with this friend of the family, the sculptor, and from there he began to apprentice for architects' offices. He got fired from one because he was also moonlighting in a stable and apparently would come in direct from the stable and was not welcome in the offices.
Odoriferous, maybe.
Yeah. And then he began to work for George Mason, who was a well-respected local architect who built actually some houses here in Ann Arbor. And he rose up through George Mason's firm to become, for a while anyway, a quasi-partner with George Mason.
Before going off and establishing Albert Kahn and Associates.
Before establishing himself on his own, right.
And as a matter of fact, the centennial of a number of his landmark works is coming up. For those of us who might not be familiar with Albert Kahn's work, name a few buildings we might recognize.
Hill Auditorium, Fisher Building in Detroit, the Cadillac Place Building, formerly called the Durant Building or the GM Building, Hatcher Library, Angel Hall, Burton Tower, Clements Library.
Yeah, so we kind of get the idea. These are
Highland Park.
Prominent buildings. For those downtown Detroit buildings, let's just stick there. What percentage were designed by Kahn or his firm? What do you have, a number? Do you have a percentage? Just a ballpark.
Yeah, I don't have a percentage. The information about Kahn's Detroit projects is wide-ranging. I would say we don't actually know. A couple of local historians have produced a count of 400 buildings in Detroit by Kahn. The firm has records for about 900 projects in Detroit. Those could be minor projects. So we're somewhere in between 400 and 900 buildings in Detroit alone.
And some of them are these massive buildings like you're talking about, like Fisher, but there's also National Theater, which, you know, is abandoned and at risk of being demolished or just not being renovated and deteriorate. So there are little jewels besides these great big mammoth projects he did as well. I understand there are a fair number at the University of Michigan as well that were designed by Albert Kahn. You mentioned a couple of them, but a good deal of campus is dotted with Albert Kahn buildings.
A huge number of buildings on Michigan's campus. Before Kahn's death in 1942, the count that I have is 19 buildings on Central Campus, and the firm went on building at Michigan long after Kahn died.
Wow. So what makes Kahn's designs or his methods different from his contemporaries?
Lots of things. Incredible efficiency in the office, in the organization of the office. Extreme responsiveness to client demands. That's quite unusual for named architects, in case you don't know that. The client is often to be resisted as much as worked with. But Kahn was...
I've heard that about people like, you know, Wright and others.
Yes. But Kahn worked really well with clients, and as a result, they came back and they hired him again and again and again. His firm structure was designed for efficiency. Some people talk about the Kahn office as itself being like a kind of factory organization. Those would be the main things. I would just note
his building materials were different too, right?
He pioneered the use of reinforced concrete together with his brother Julius Kahn. And really, Julius gets the credit for inventing a proprietary system of reinforced concrete that was called Truss-Kahn, or the Kahn system, that became a global, literally a global enterprise. It was co-owned by Julius and Albert together. I don't think we quite know yet the extent of the networks of Truss-Kahn, but I can tell you they went all the way across the globe, up and down, east and west, north and south, everywhere.
We talked about some of these stately buildings, but Kahn also designed plants for Henry Ford, a part of the massive abandoned Packard plant in Detroit. But it was Kahn's Highland Park Ford plant, which really was a game changer for a lot of people. How important was that building at the time and why?
Well, Highland Park is often and not quite accurately credited as the site of the moving assembly line in automotive manufacture. It was tremendously important, as I would call it, a laboratory for assembly line manufacture or for mass production of automobiles and machines. And I say that because when they first designed it, they had a certain understanding of what was needed. But over time, the factory, almost immediately, in fact, the factory became obsolete in terms of the demand that was placed on Ford Motor Company. And so they were constantly tinkering with the building, adding to it, expanding, trying to figure out ways to keep up with the accelerating demand for automobiles. And really, Highland Park is, I think, most important as a kind of laboratory that then resulted in the River Rouge plant.
Kahn's firm grew quickly and not only designed auto plants in Detroit, but when World War II broke out, he was instrumental in designing these huge manufacturing plants for the war effort. Tell me a little bit about that.
That's a remarkable story in the Kahn story history. He had already pioneered incredibly efficient, low-cost, high-quality factory buildings. up to the late 30s. But by the time you get into the kind of ambit of World War II, he's forced to reinvent himself yet again. And that begins with very rapid manufacture in steel frame building for war production. But after we joined the war, i.e. from the end of 1941, material shortages made Kahn redesign the systems that he had in place already for at least two changed conditions. One was the need to have artificially lit factories, or blackout factories, and two was the constraints on materials like steel, so that he had to go back to concrete, finding ways to reduce the amount of metal that he used to reinforce it so that he could build the factories equally quickly, but with a very different palette of materials from those that he had used in the late 30s.
And some of these were huge. The Willow Run bomber plant in Ypsilanti was one of the biggest buildings around at the time. How large was it?
I think it was about 82 acres under one roof, if I'm not mistaken. Kahn refers in a speech to it being 90 acres under one roof. But I've read the statistic 82 as well. It's an agricultural scale. It's not a building scale. Right. You have to think about it in terms of farmland. That's how much land was under that one L-shaped roof in Ypsilanti.
Yeah, forget square footage. Starting in 1929, Albert Kahn developed a business relationship with the Soviet Union. He helped industrialize a country that was kind of lagging behind the rest of the developed world. How important was Kahn's work to the rise of Russia and the Soviet Union as a world power?
I'm not an expert on this, but I think it was immense. They designed and set in place the building of 523 factories through the Moscow office of Albert Kahn Associates. But the reason that the Soviets didn't renew the contract in 1932 was, I think, because they no longer needed Kahn. They had all his drawings, and they had a group of trained technicians, technicians trained by the Kahn outfit. They simply didn't need him anymore. When they negotiated the contract renewal, they offered to pay him in rubles instead of dollars. And to Kahn, rubles were useless. He knew it was a ruse to cancel the contract, and he accepted it philosophically. What went on after, what happened after those 523 factories were built, my supposition is that there was a kind of ripple effect, and the techniques, the technology that they had brought to the Soviet Union was the main element in industrializing the entire country. I think it was immense.
As we mentioned, this is the centennial of some of his works. What's being done to recognize Albert Kahn as these buildings are noted?
LTU has been quite wonderful recently. They themselves have the Kahn office library, moved lock, stock, and barrel from the Albert Kahn building to the LTU library in the mid-1970s. Recently, they've cataloged the collection. They've come to understand that it's a fascinating time capsule of Kahn's work. And as a result of wanting to celebrate this holding, they've sponsored a couple of exhibitions on Kahn's work. One is an exhibition called Albert Kahn Under Construction, which features the incredible archive of unpublished construction photographs of buildings built all over the world by Kahn. They are also exhibiting these lost drawings of Belle Isle Aquarium. And this is the Belle Isle Aquarium find is thanks to the hard work of Chris Meister, who's a local historian who's done some of the most groundbreaking and interesting work on Albert Kahn, and has been instrumental to the restoration and the reopening of the Belle Isle Aquarium. That is an amazing building. It's a beautiful, beautiful jewel of a building connected to the greenhouse, the conservatory next door. It's one of the earliest aquaria in the United States, and until its closure in 2005, it was the longest continuously operating aquarium in the U.S. I don't care about that so much. It is a beautiful building that summons up the experience of being underwater. I can't describe it any other way. It's tiled in green glass tiles. It's just a wonderful, wonderful place. And Chris Meister has done an incredible job of promoting it and taking care of it and assembling others or working with others to take care of that building. And in general, I'd say that the new recognition of Kahn is not so much a function of any particular date, but a growing understanding of the importance of industrialization to the American economy, to the built environment, to the Midwest as we find it today, with this immense amount of infrastructure that's basically falling apart or being demolished. There's somehow a new understanding that this period of American history has been not quite adequately analyzed by those who study the built environment, and that we're still living with its effects, either because the buildings are still here or precisely because they aren't. So the landscape of Detroit would be the best example of that, filled with empty pockets left by the immense building campuses that Kahn designed for Dodge, for Chrysler, for Ford.
For Packard.
For Packard.
On our website, we will list some of the events that are going on. If you'd like to visit Lawrence Tech and see some of these exhibits, we'll let you know what's going on there. Our guest, Claire Zimmerman, is an associate professor of architecture and history of art at the University of Michigan and with the College of Architecture and Design and Exhibitions and Lectures Committee at Lawrence Tech. She's currently writing a book about Albert Kahn. So thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
Well, Cheers is on the road again, and this time we are in Detroit.
That's right. We're here in honor of Black History Month, and we're talking to bartender Amas Muhammad at Selden Standard.
And we've got a drink here. Let's talk about the drink first. What did you make for us?
So I decided to make for you guys, it's called For a Fistful of Dollars. It's a smoky scotch drink, a little curacao, so it has a citrus back to it, and it also has a toasted bay leaf, kind of offer a smoky nose on it as well.
Can you tell us quickly how to make this?
Sure. It is a 1/4 ounce of simple syrup, 3/4 ounces of dry curacao, 1/2 ounce of Lafroy, 10-year, or you could use 2 James peated whiskey for that, keep that smoky scotch character, and 1.5 ounces of banknote blended scotch. You add all the ingredients into your stirring vessel, and you stir for about 30 to 50 rotations. That's properly diluted. Pour into a rocks glass over a large ice cube, and you're going to flame an orange peel. And then for the finishing, I put dried bay leaf on the top, and I slightly toast it, and it really has this nice crackle, and it really releases a lot of aromatics. It really ties the drink together. So.
Not all of us have a nice bar blowtorch. How else could we toast that?
You can definitely use just a regular match. You just keep the flame a little bit over the top of the leaf. It's really dry, so it'll catch pretty easily.
And I just use an Amen flame, like you'd use to light your barbecue. That works great anytime you need to flame something for a drink. So we really wanted to talk to you because in honor of Black History Month, we wanted to learn more about the history of African Americans in the craft cocktail industry.
It's pretty amazing for an industry that's blown up and is so obsessed with history and the notoriety of cocktails and the tall tales and legends of how cocktails came to be, we really miss huge swaths of the people who helped create this industry that we really love. People of color have been instrumental since the beginning of spirits in America in building and cultivating this craft.
How far back?
The famous bartender, the first one we have on record, is a man named Cato Alexander, who's a black slave who was born in New York in 1780. And he was freed by 19. By 30, he owned his own tavern just outside of Manhattan. It was the sportiest bar in all of America. There was a newspaper that said, if you don't know Cato Alexander's, you don't know the world.
So it's a long history of people of color who actually been in this industry, created the drinks, and it's overlooked.
Oh, absolutely. There are so many. That's just one example of many, many. And unfortunately, there are even more that we will never know. A lot of the head distillers and these infamous whiskey distillers we know were indentured slaves.
Tammy, how's the drink?
The drink is delicious. That nose from that toasted bay leaf is really amazing. And so I've been sitting here sipping this while listening to Amas talk.
I understand you guys are going to be teaching how to make this drink?
That's right. This is going to be one of a bunch of drinks that we're going to be teaching at the end of the month when we collaborate on a class on February 20th in Ann Arbor. That's about the history of African Americans and people of color in bartending.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. It's something that's really important to me, and I look forward to sharing all of it that I know with you guys.
We'll link to Tammy's tastings where you can find out about those classes and that particular one. Well, thanks very much, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There is another executive order on immigration issued by President Trump. It's not been getting as much attention. It's beyond the seven-country immigration ban. This executive order gave the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement broader discretion to arrest undocumented immigrants. The result's been a quick uptick in arrests, more people in detention centers, and an immigrant community that's more fearful of being deported. According to the New York Times, this order stipulates that undocumented immigrants convicted of any criminal offense, and even those who have not been charged but are believed to have committed acts that constitute a chargeable criminal offense, have become a priority for deportation. Joining me now is Brad Mays. He's a lawyer who works on immigration cases. What's your biggest concern about this new executive order?
My biggest concern, Lester, is that this gives unfettered power to Immigration and Customs Enforcement to essentially be the judge, jury, and executioner when they come across someone who may be illegal, and to search out those people who are regular citizens, who are contributing to our community, and who are just caught up in the fray of these executive orders.
I understand one of your clients is being detained right now.
That's correct, yes.
Well, what's the name?
His name is Javier. I don't want to use his last name if I could avoid that right now. He was arrested last week. He was actually with someone driving to work, and the Immigration Customs Enforcement were looking for someone else. And when they found out that he didn't have proper documentation, they arrested him. So he was kind of collateral damage of an arrest that they were attempting to make. Typically, they would have released him, but they put him in custody. He has been here for 27 years. He has four U.S. citizen children, ages 2, 10, 11, and 16 years old. He has been employed for much of the time in the United States. He has no criminal convictions. He has his own home, which he bought in Detroit. And there is no reason at all to upset the community, to arrest this young man.
You mentioned the children. We actually have a 16-year-old, also named Javier, on the phone with us. Welcome, Javier. What's the arrest or detention of your father meant to the family?
Well, it's been really, like, depressing at home. Like all of us, we miss our dad, my mom. She's been trying to keep it together for us because it's very hard, you know, because it's like a different vibe when my dad's not home. And, well, I have to keep strong, too, because I'm, like, basically the man of the house right now while my dad's gone.
Right, you're the oldest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of pressure. Like, it's very hard.
Are you and your brothers and sisters all born in the U.S.?
Yeah, all of us.
And so right now there is some protection for you.
Yeah.
What would you do if, you know, you don't have a head of household and you don't have the income? What are you going to do?
Well, my mom says that if my dad gets sent to Mexico, she's not going to go back to Mexico with him because, like, she wants my sisters and my little brother to grow up here. And then once they're all grown up, maybe she to live with my dad, but I'm going to have to get a job to help around the house because she wants my little brothers to have a good life here in the U.S., and they want them to graduate here. We'll miss them a lot, and I'll miss them a lot because I want them to be here for my graduation, which is next year.
All right, Javier, thanks very much for probably need to get back to classes now. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Yeah, of course.
Brad Mays, are we seeing an uptick in these Immigration and Customs Enforcement pickups like this?
Yes, we are, Lester. Essentially, after the executive orders a few weeks ago, the following Monday, ICE received their marching orders, and which was to go out and arrest anybody and everybody they think may be undocumented. And as you mentioned, it gives them the ability to arrest people that they think are security or public safety risks, or who have been charged with a crime. So someone who has been pulled over for a driving with suspended license or a speeding ticket suddenly falls into their purview.
I wanted to bring that up. I mean, because, you know, we think of traffic offenses, we don't think of them as criminal, but Michigan does not even issue driver's license to undocumented people. So if they're trying to drive to work or take the kids to school, that's an act that would lead to arrest, detention, and possibly deportation?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened to Javier, Javier Jr.'s father, is that he was on his way to work. He wasn't even driving. And you're right that the state of Michigan does not give driver's licenses to undocumented people. Now, if they did, these people would be licensed to drive, and they wouldn't have to worry about that. These are just regular salt of our community. They're the underbelly of our economy. They're doing a lot of the blue-collar jobs. Some of them are working one or two jobs. I know that the gentleman that was arrested was, you know, his employer was shocked and this happened, and it's really affecting his business and his bottom line. So this is really affecting us in a social and economic way, and really we have to ask ourselves, is this worth the moral cost to just go out and arrest people and suddenly become like we're kind of a police state?
This crackdown didn't come out of nowhere, though, because Trump has been clear that he wants to crack down on undocumented immigrants. His supporters support that. So let's ask the basic question. Why should legal U.S. citizens be concerned about the deportation of people who are here illegally?
Right. I guess the question we have to ask is, what are we trying to achieve here? Yes, we want people who have committed crimes to no longer be amongst our communities. But these are regular people who have been part of our communities for dozens and dozens of years. The gentleman who was arrested has been here since 1989. He's been here for 27 years. So we can't just address this issue of undocumented immigrants with a sledgehammer. You deal with it with a scalpel, and you say, these are the people we want, these are the people we don't want, and let's move on. Our country is, you know, it's founded on immigrants and immigrants trying to reach their dreams. And I think that this really goes against our value system to just handle it the way we're doing.
Brad Mays is an immigration attorney. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much, Lester. I appreciate it.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham.
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
A listener recently asked us to answer this question. What does the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, do in Michigan? Well, we're turning to Nick Schreck. He's the director of the Transnational Environmental Law Clinic at the Wayne State University Law School. Welcome to the program. So let's talk generally. What does the EPA do for Michigan?
Well, a lot. The EPA has the oversight responsibility for our major federal environmental laws. So when you hear about the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, those are laws that EPA has the oversight responsibility from our federal government. And here in Michigan, we have what's called delegated authority in the state, where our Michigan Department of Environmental Quality does things like reviewing permit applications for a major source of air pollution or reviewing permit applications for water pollution. And EPA monitors all of our Michigan DEQ's permitting activity in the state. And in fact, DEQ can object if our DEQ fails to follow the letter of the federal law or if they're not, you know, implementing it as fully as EPA would like to see happen. So every time a business in the state is getting a permit that allows them to emit air pollution or water pollution, in some respects, our EPA is involved. So at a very big level, I mean, everyday activity going on in the state is somehow regulated by EPA. They're also involved in a number of very important research and grant programs that provide for cleanup of contaminated sites in Michigan or research on the Great Lakes, things that are, you know, very important to our everyday life. They come through, pass-through money from EPA into the state of Michigan for all of that great work to take place.
So let's talk about one that people might be familiar with, and that's the oil spill, the Enbridge pipeline that broke near Marshall, Michigan, and spilled into the Kalamazoo River. What was the EPA role?
Yes, so EPA, part of their function is to be with the first responders when major incidents like an oil spill take place. EPA sends in experts, they have a rapid response team, and EPA helps to train first responders and DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality staff in the state of Michigan so that they can be there when a spill happens and try and contain it as quickly as possible. And then EPA, in regards to the Kalamazoo River oil spill, EPA took the lead role in ensuring that the cleanup standards were met. And so, in fact, EPA was really driving the bus as far as making sure that Enbridge was doing what they said they would do to clean up that oil spill, tracking the benchmarks to make sure that they were meeting the cleanup standards when they said that they would. And so, you know, EPA really had a major oversight role to make sure that that river was cleaned up as quickly and as efficiently as possible.
I want to talk about Superfund sites because there are 65 Superfund sites in Michigan. What are they and what is the EPA's role?
So the Superfund program was developed out of an act of Congress that intended to clean up the worst, most contaminated, hazardous sites that we have all across our country. And a lot of these sites are what we would call legacy sites, meaning that they're left over from companies that may not exist anymore or old manufacturing-type facilities that have been bought up by other companies. The sites are so toxic that they're not going to be cleaned up on their own without some investment from our federal government. And that means grants, that means technical oversight and expertise. And the Superfund program initially was funded by a tax on oil and petrochemical companies and gas companies to create this pot of money to help clean up these really contaminated sites. Because remember, prior to the 1970s, we didn't have the same type of environmental laws we have today that tracked and prohibited people from dumping really nasty chemicals either on the land or in the water. And so the Superfund program, there's a list that's called the National Priorities List, and these are a list of sites that we have determined as a people here in the United States that it is most important to clean these up as quickly and efficiently as possible and to provide some resources. So that tax that I mentioned to create the Superfund, that tax was not reauthorized, meaning that it was eliminated back in the 1990s. And so now we depend on Congress to appropriate money to the EPA to run the Superfund program. And you can probably guess where this is going. Over the last several years, there has been less and less money appropriated by Congress into the Superfund program to allow these cleanups to take place. That means those 65 sites in Michigan are not getting an appropriate amount of resources to help clean them up and put that property or water in some cases. Some of these Superfund sites are ports and adjacent to the Great Lakes, to get those sites back up to a treatment standard where the property can be put to productive use, meaning that you or I or anyone can use it for recreation or that it could be used for redevelopment.
So there's a couple of things we've been talking about. Of course, the role of the EPA in the environment goes a lot further. There are protections for the Great Lakes. They're responsible for that. They're responsible for state revolving loans that allow municipalities to improve sewer treatment plants or water treatment plants. The EPA had a role in the Flint crisis, first a failure to do anything, and a whistleblower within the EPA who, if he had not been there, Miguel Del Toro, we still might not know about Flint's lead problems. So
that's right.
There are some real big benefits to the EPA. Let's talk about what's happening right now. The money that the EPA uses, the grants and so forth, the Trump administration has frozen the EPA's ability to send money to state agencies or anything else. Why did that happen and what's the impact?
Well, the why question is a tough one to figure out. I think there was a sense from the new Trump administration that they did not have a handle on where all of this money was being sent from EPA, what types of programs it was funding, and they wanted to get a better handle on where all of that money was going. And so they initiated this freeze. And I think that there were a lot of unintended consequences there, you know, giving the administration the benefit of the doubt, that they perhaps didn't understand how important money from EPA is to contractors that are handling the cleanup of these Superfund sites, like we just talked about, these really contaminated sites, or funds made available for initial response to an environmental disaster, like an oil spill. Without those grant monies available, all of that grinds to a halt. And so it was really shocking to anyone who works in this field when that happened, because it really was an unintended and irresponsible approach, because there are all of these really important key programs and, again, contractors, people working on cleanup that were not going to get paid if that freeze remains in place. So, again, I think it was an attempt to try and figure out exactly where, you know, large sums of federal money are being spent, no doubt about it. But I think the unanticipated consequence was that a lot of key important programs that are really essential to public health and the environment were put on hold, and that can have some really dire consequences.
President Donald Trump's nominee for administrator of the EPA is Scott Pruitt. He's the Oklahoma Attorney General and a self-professed enemy of the EPA. He's sued the agency about 14 times, and he really wants to reduce the influence and power of the EPA. First of all, do you think his nomination will be approved, and what do you think that's going to mean to the EPA?
Whether or not Mr. Pruitt is approved as administrator of the EPA, there's already been a message sent by the Trump administration, and that is that EPA is on notice that a lot of their prior regulations, rules that have been passed, are now being overturned by Congress, or Congress is attempting to overturn them. And the fact that Pruitt was actually nominated for this position says a lot, because, in fact, as Attorney General in Oklahoma, he has had multiple lawsuits against the EPA and often questioned EPA's authority to implement the various environmental protection programs that we have across this country. So regardless of whether or not he's confirmed, the message has already been sent that, you know, EPA should be on notice that times are changing under the Trump administration for sure.
So there's a little bit about what the EPA does in Michigan and what the future of the agency might be in the United States. We've been talking to Nick Schreck. He's the director of the Transnational Environmental Law Clinic at the Wayne State University Law School. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Here at Stateside, we get a few comments from listeners. Several people let us know how they felt about Cynthia Canty's interview with the chair of the Michigan House Appropriations Committee, Representative Laura Cox. Matthew tweeted, "Cindy Canty is asking the hard questions on Michigan radio. Way to go. Hold government accountable." We got an email from Barb who says, "Thanks to Cindy Canty for boldly but kindly trying to get Ms. Cox to explain which states have actually succeeded in lowering taxes and got good results." We also heard from Teresa. Cynthia Canty was right to ask which states were studied to make these decisions. It was apparent by Ms. Cox's answers that not much research went into her plan. Now, some listeners were not at all happy with my interview with Gary Nairt with Great Lakes Education Project, a DeVos-founded and funded organization. Sharon wrote, "I was listening to Stateside on my way home from my job as a speech-language pathologist and certified teacher at a public school. I was dismayed to hear you give a platform to Betsy DeVos's spokesperson and GLEP's executive director, Gary Nairt. I vented on a local political activism Facebook page that I was disappointed in Stateside, and if I couldn't count on NPR, who could I count on? You should know that the immediate response was that I could no longer count on NPR because you're too worried about losing federal funding." Margaret wrote, "If that's the kind of misinformation you'll be presenting on your show in the future, you have lost a listener, and many others will stop listening also." Whether praising us or criticizing what we're doing, we want to hear from you. Send us an email, stateside@michiganradio.org, or a tweet at Stateside Radio. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia, engineered by Rusty Brock, who's trying not to get his breadcrumbs all over the equipment today. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening, and hey, have a great weekend.